Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit.
At a breast cancer awareness and fundraiser, the male MC said he was very comfortable talking about breasts. In fact, he said, breasts are two of his favorite things. Breasts are not talked about a lot in polite society, even though they get a lot of attention. Breast augmentation or reduction, breast cancer, breastfeeding, wardrobe malfunctions, show us your boobs. They get a lot of attention. We're intimately familiar with breasts, seeing them change over the years, from butts to boobs to huge milk producers to droops. At first, we can't wait for them to show up. Then we dread the later stage. I know of a 40s woman who said she noticed her girls in the mirror. That's what she called them, the girls, and said to them, "What are you looking at down there?" We don't want to be too reverent about breasts on the Jin radio show, so we're going to call them boobs. And this is not our first show on the topic, so we call it Another Boob Show. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and I'm Anmarai Roque, in for Sandy Billings. And this is Another Boob Show. We'll begin by going around town. Recent statistics have shown that the number of young women getting breast enlargement has risen significantly in the last decade, with a 300% increase in breast augmentations among all age groups, and a shocking 500% increase in the number of women 18 and younger. So I went around the University of Idaho campus asking young women how they feel about breast surgery.
Would you ever get breast surgery?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think if you're comfortable with your body, then I think you should, you know, do what makes you happy. I don't necessarily believe in, like, complete fakeness. But, you know, if it's, like, a tiny alteration, I don't see anything wrong with that. Yeah. I think it depends on the person and their motivation behind it. I think if they have, you know, if they have good reasons, you know, some people get in accidents or some people have different size breasts, then I'm all for that. You know, but if somebody is looking for attention, like, in a negative way, I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm not going to tell them they can't do it, but I don't know, I think it's right.
Well, what's wrong with your boobs? You want it bigger?
Maybe, but I'm going to wait till after I have kids, because my mom went from, like, an A to a double D, so we'll see what happens.
What's the biggest size you would go up to?
Double E, just a joke. No.
That's so heavy.
I think I could comfortably be a C.
Yeah.
Right now, I thought I would be fine with that.
Would you ever get breast surgery?
Maybe. I mean, it's not totally out of the question. Maybe after kids, they need a little help. Seriously, I think about breast surgery. If you know you want to do it for yourself, there's no problem with it, you know? If that's something you like to do. I've had friends who've gotten breast augmentation, and they've always said that it pays for itself and free drinks, so there you go.
But that's for doing it for attention, then.
If you want to get more attention on yourself, but I think, you know, if I don't think you should do it necessarily to instill confidence in yourself, you know, but hey, if it's something you like to do, then go for it.
What's the biggest size you would get?
Probably a full C, small D.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not too big. You don't want to look ostentatious.
It's true.
Honestly, if I had the funds to do it, And I knew that it was absolutely safe if they like pioneered some new technology where I knew I wasn't gonna, you know, someone was gonna burst and leak and kill me. I hate to admit it, but probably.
Well, why do you hate to admit it?
Because I would like to be more satisfied with my body. I think that, you know, we're all looking at Barbie and we're like, hey, how can we make ourselves look that way? And
I know.
You know, not maybe Barbie, she's got crazy pointy boobs, but I just...
You know, it's been proven if you were to put Barbie in life size, she would fall over.
She would look like a dinosaur. No, honestly, I just think that for me personally, I'd be more proportional and, you know, be a little more to squeeze. And I think it'd be nice, you know? It's kind of like... makes you look more feminine and filled out, so...
Would you?
If I had cancer and had to get one lopped off, but probably not, because it just proves how insecure you are about your chest, I think. Same with, like, a nose job or liposuction or anything.
Yeah.
I think it says a lot about somebody when they do that.
I think that your body is made the way that it's supposed to be, and you shouldn't have to get surgery.
I think it's definitely important to embrace like how God made you, but after I have kids and my boobs don't look like they do now, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be a little upset. So well, talk to me in like 10 years or something.
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I think if I was going to spend that much money, I'd probably spend it doing something else. I think if you feel like you need to have a breast enlargement for yourself, then that's what you need to do, I suppose, as long as it's safe. Although, I guess it's really not, they're finding out it's really not that safe anymore. But breast reduction, I think, is fine. I don't know. I think as long as you're doing it for yourself and you're not doing it because somebody else is telling you you need bigger or smaller boobs.
What about you? Would you ever get breast surgery?
Not unless possibly I'd considered if I had breast cancer and lost my shape as a woman. But I think as far as adding to what I already have, I don't really see a need for that. I think that's a culturally driven thing and not something that Jesus would promote in saying, you know, everything is about your body. It's more about the heart and what's on the inside.
Would you ever get breast surgery?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, I like my situation, how it is right now. I don't know. It's all your personal choice, though. I just would never. No, but it's a woman's choice. If she wants to, if she does it for the right reasons, why not?
Yes. Okay. Reduction.
Yeah.
My back hurts.
What size would be your ideal size?
I don't know. I'd be fine if they were just a normal D.
Normal D.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind having big boobs, just not this big.
What about you?
I think that I'm fine where I am, but sometimes I feel like it's weird when you like exercise, depending on how much like work you're doing and stuff, they fluctuate, and that's annoying. So I guess I'd rather them be like a steady one size all the time. But I guess I probably wouldn't.
What about after kids?
I guess we'll find out. I don't know.
How about you?
I would probably say no. Not saying that I like my boobs, but I just probably wouldn't. I mean, I don't need them smaller, and I don't need them much bigger, I guess, because I feel like people that do have bigger boobs have problems with backs and stuff, so I don't know.
How about you?
Right now I'm fine, but if I have kids and they get any bigger, then I would probably get a reduction.
Yep. I would never go bigger.
No. I think that'd be a bad idea for me.
Would you ever get breast surgery?
Only if I had some kind of cancer or medical reason, and I had to replace them somehow, or make them healthy again.
Yeah. What do you think of breast surgery in general?
It seems kind of unnecessary to me. If you're trying to get a guy by getting breast surgery, maybe that guy wouldn't like you for who you are, so maybe it's not really worth it.
Good to go. Hey, I'm
for installment number 2, genetics. Genetics are the basic ties between families. For the Jane family, a genetic mutation brought breast cancer into the family.
I am thankful and honored to be able to be here today to tell you my story, and I want to dedicate this to my mother, Sharon Lou Jane Iverson, who died of breast cancer at age 53 in 1991.
That's Karen Peterson at the start of a keynote talk she presented at last fall's Pink Tea. That's a fundraiser to provide breast cancer screenings to women who can't afford them. Karen's part of a close family that includes many women with the last name Jane. Plain Janes, farmer girls. 6 of them were at this Pink Tea.
We always say we're farm, you know, we're just plain old farm girls, and I really think of myself that way. But we, there's not really a high maintenance one among us, so we're not, we just have always known and have been taught that life's precious. Yes.
These Janes aren't so plain. In fact, they have an extraordinary story, a story that one of them, Karen Peterson, shared at the Pink Tea fundraiser last fall. Karen is BRCA2 positive. So are at least 5 others in her generation. So is her aunt. Her mother might have been, too. Being BRCA2 positive means that Karen and her relatives have a rare inherited genetic mutation that makes it highly likely that they will get breast cancer. It also increases the risk of ovarian cancer. Women and men can have the gene and can pass it on. In men, it increases the risk of breast, prostate, and other cancers. Karen told her family story to a group of some 300, predominantly women dressed in pink, bright fuchsia and pastel, some in flowers and pink accessories. Even the men wore pink. Karen was in basic black with a small, simple pink ribbon on her sweater.
So my story starts with my mother. Her illness and death really greatly affected my immediate and extended family. She was first diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 48, and it was really tough. She fought that for 5 years, and but the cancer kept returning. And during her illness and her death, we just struggled to understand why this had happened to her. We wondered if it was, you know, was it some exposure to some farm chemical? Was it Hanford? Or, you know, what was the cause? She had always taken really great care of herself. She didn't smoke. She didn't drink to excess. And seemingly, she had no risk factors. We just couldn't get it. For most of my adult life, especially after her diagnosis, I've always felt like I was going to get breast cancer. And I'm not a fatalist, but it was just the sense of when was it going to happen rather than if it was going to happen. I had that lack of control, and there was some fear there as well. And my sister told me she felt the same way. We felt that if this could happen to our mother, the last person that you would expect it to happen to, it could happen to us as well. In 2003, my 41-year-old cousin Mark was diagnosed with bilateral breast cancer, and that means breast cancer on both sides. He was fortunate to have a friend who was a surgeon who happened to notice the lumps and went in to get them checked. It turned out to be cancer. Fortunately, today he is healthy and doing well, but that was just like, whoa, you know, couldn't imagine that happening. The next year, Mark's mother, my Aunt Alice, was diagnosed with breast cancer as well. And she elected to have a mastectomy, but she started to recognize that something was wrong in our family. So, understanding and hearing about genetic testing, she went to her oncologist and asked and insisted that he let her have the genetic testing done, and that's what she did.
Aunt Alice had to insist on that test, too. Here's Aunt Alice, Alice Jane Spray.
Because my son had it, that was my red flag. My oncologist said, I'm 99% sure. This is rare. I don't think you have it. But finally, I said, well, I am having it done. And he said, well, if you insist. I said, if the insurance won't pay it, I'll pay it. But I'm going to have it done. And so that's, he said, well, okay. and then he came back. And they never tell you in person if it's positive or negative. And they tell you going in, they will not tell you. So that you don't think because they called you in you have it, or they don't think because they didn't call you. It's not going to be in the mail. You go in so that they are going to talk to you either way. And he said, oh, you were right. So,
and in doing that, she saved our generation. Because what would have happened next is we would have all had to get it, and then we would have known to test.
Yeah, one by one.
It's a simple blood test. She had that done, and it was sent away to a lab. When it came back, she found that she was positive for the BRCA2 gene. And that's a mutation, a mutated gene. This test does not determine whether a person has cancer or not, but it does tell you whether a person carries the gene, a change in one of these genes. She sent a letter then to members of our family and to anybody that she thought might be affected, particularly nieces, nephews, and cousins, and explained about the gene and what the testing options were. And now we knew the why. We knew why my mother had gotten sick. So, in a warped kind of way, it was nice to know that there was a reason for it, but scary nonetheless. Over the spring and summer of 2005, seven of us, all first and second cousins, decided to do genetic testing too. Genetic counseling is really strongly recommended. If you're going to do the genetic testing, it's important to understand about the gene, what the ramifications are, and what the outcomes might be. Because we had my aunt's particular information to send, we sent that with our blood test, and when the testing was done, they specifically looked for the mutation that she had. So it was a less expensive test for us, and we knew exactly what we were looking for. The tests came back over the spring and summer of 2005, and one by one, six of seven of us found out we had the gene mutation. So we also make the assumption that Mark was positive because he had breast cancer as well. All of us were women between 40 and 50. All of us were married with children. We started researching the BRCA2 gene mutation and gathering information. Each of us contacted our physicians, compared notes, and kept in touch as we learned more. We learned that only a small percent of the population actually carry this gene. It's not rampant out there, there's just a small percentage. We learned that our children have a 50-50 chance to inherit the gene, and it can be passed from mothers or fathers. It's not a sex-linked gene. We also recognize that when our children are old enough to understand, we'll need to have a discussion with them about what this means for them. That's another whole discussion I won't go into today, but that is part of it. And at that time, we learned that women with this gene mutation have up to a 90% chance of developing breast cancer in their lifetime and a 40 to 45% chance of ovarian cancer. So needless to say, the odds are pretty sobering. We learned that we needed to educate ourselves in order to ask the right questions. We asked a ton of questions. We sought out oncologists, our primary care physicians, the breast surgeons, general surgeons, anybody that would talk to us. We asked questions and tried to understand what was happening and what we could do about this. We asked questions until we were satisfied that we could make an informed and educated decision about what we needed to do. And we prayed about it. And we had a lot of people praying for us, too. Our options were a total hysterectomy, including removal of the ovaries. That's important because that takes out the hormone part. Hormones can feed cancer cells. So they said if we would have a hysterectomy, we would reduce our risk of ovarian cancer almost completely. And it would reduce our breast cancer risk by about half. We could have a preventative bilateral mastectomy, and that would essentially eliminate our breast cancer risk as well. It's pretty drastic, but our risk would be almost nothing compared to 9 to 10% in the general population. We could basically do nothing. We could continue to do self-breast exams. We could do the MRIs and mammograms and just do watchful waiting. But that was all of the specialists that we talked to discouraged us from doing that because we were middle-aged and we had this gene. So they suggested the very minimum, even though for some women, the double mastectomy just may be too much. He said at the very minimum, they would recommend this hysterectomy with the oophorectomy, taking out the ovaries. So that's what we were encouraged to do. And then lastly, we learned that there are excellent reconstructive options. There's implants. You can do implants or transplant reconstruction, which is when you use your own tissue and skin and reconstruct the breast that way. And this reconstruction could be immediate. So this wasn't easy to sort through. We didn't have cancer, but we had some unique emotional privacy and medical concerns to work through. The emotional concerns were obvious. You know, there's the body image and sexuality part. You know, how is my body going to look? What am I going to think about that? And what's my husband going to think about that? And what's the reconstruction going to look like? Those are real concerns. And not only that, now we're looking also at menopause coming ahead. Even though, you know, I was in my mid-40s and I knew menopause was looming, I really wasn't too anxious to get there any sooner than I had to. So medical concerns included just the fact that it's a lot of surgery, so making plans for work and also plans for how to get help at home when we were recovering. And then I was worried about my insurance too. I was worried that it wouldn't cover the surgery or the reconstruction. And in fact, when I had the genetic testing done, I paid for my own testing because I was worried about the ramifications for my insurance. Would it raise my rates? Could I be insured? What would happen down the road with that? So I just learned, though, that there is new legislation. It's called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA. Was signed into law May 21st of 2008. And this is federal legislation that prohibits health insurance and employment discrimination on the basis of genetic information or a genetic test result. So this really paves the way for people to take full advantage of personalized medicine without worrying about discrimination. It's really, really great news. So this was a huge decision, and I don't want to make light of it. On one hand, it seems like a no-brainer, but you know, it just wasn't that easy, especially when you consider all the things I just talked about. I wanted to be proactive, and I recognize that a lot of people survive breast cancer, but having gone through it with my mom, I did not want to do that. And I didn't want to be facing this same decision with a cancer diagnosis down the road, especially given the odds of that I could develop breast cancer. I wanted to be here for my then 10-year-old and the husband that I'm crazy about and the rest of my family. So, and I also want to point out that our spouses and families were very, very supportive, but ultimately it's a really personal decision that each of us had to make. In 2005, one by one, we made our individual decisions and took action. My aunt decided to have a preemptive mastectomy on her healthy breast with bilateral, meaning both sides, reconstruction. Some of us had hysterectomies, followed later by the mastectomy with the reconstruction, and some of us did it all at once. I was one of the ones that did it all at once, and I ended up having transplant reconstruction, which means that they transplant, as I said earlier, tissue and skin to reconstruct my breasts. And I tell you, I used to joke that I would have the perfect body if I could just move my stomach up. Little did I know I would be doing that someday. It's like, I don't know. Be careful what you ask for.
Karen's youngest cousin, Amy, finished her surgeries last year. Here's Amy.
Now, Amy has been the last one to have the surgery, which was, the breast surgery was...
Was I after you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
You were just last year.
Okay.
She was in February after me. You were in February of 06.
Right, okay. It was Karen. I was a year ago. Mm-hmm. I had the mastectomy. Mm-hmm.
Just a year ago. Well, kind of the star,
a
honey.
A little over a year ago, June.
It's a 12-hour surgery. It's not easy. And it's not a tonsillectomy. I mean,
I think Karen said it's not for sissies. Yeah.
I sell real estate in Lewiston, so everything in my life relates to where people live, and I call it the full remodel.
But you're the one that had the precancerous.
Yeah.
But she would have had cancer, yes.
And my mother died just this past year of breast cancer. It's my dad's family that has it, but my mom died of breast cancer. And she didn't have any family history at all. So, it was definitely coming for me. And I, like Karen said, I couldn't be happier with my decision. But I know we've all had this conversation with each other, but people do look at you when you make a decision to do something that radical. We didn't think it was radical. We thought it was common sense. But people really look at you as if you maybe are a little crazy, that you take healthy tissue and get rid of it. But for us, it was just a, like Karen said, a no-brainer, I think.
partly, it was a very informed decision.
And partly because we watched my sister fight it for 5 years, and it just kept coming back, and she could never get ahead of it. And if you've watched that, you'll do anything not to go through that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a huge weight off your shoulders afterward. Mm-hmm. Even though it's hard to go through it, you're glad you did it, because there's not that black cloud following you everywhere.
And
you
if
know,
she
do I
known
have cancer
this,
now? Do I have cancer now? Will I get it tomorrow? Yeah. Will I get it next week? You know.
This mammogram,
you
this
put it
one.
Behind you.
Yeah, if she'd known, she'd have done
if
it.
If she'd known,
right
she'd
away.
Be here.
Right.
Yeah. She wouldn't have hesitated.
It's really been a gift, you know.
So the body image thing that Karen mentioned, is that, I mean, I'm sure it went into the decision factor, but then afterwards, I mean, is everybody just perky so it's all okay? Or is
nobody,
there something
we didn't
more
know anybody that,
that
it had it done, okay. So...
Well, we all had each other to learn from. And
Connie showed me. It was okay.
I showed
yeah.
them all.
Did you?
So it was all right.
I was saying, it's kind of like, do you worry about what you're going to look like more than you worry about if you're going to die? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. You put it in that perspective.
Yeah. We had good
There's
spousal
no,
support, too.
It's mm-hmm. not. It's not the most important thing. No. Fortunately for all of us, we're all happy with how we look now. But mm-hmm. even
but
if
we
weren't...
Have to be. When I first learned about it, I didn't know about the reconstruction, that we would do it the way we did, the tram flap. I didn't know that. And so it was worth it to me just to be, to have nothing if that's what I had to. So it was a real bonus. But Karen and I were talking the other night on the phone about it, and I said, you know, your body changes. And I as a 20-year-old, I wouldn't recognize the 44-year-old I am. And I'm sure the 44-year-old will look different than the 66. And so it's just a different stage, and it's not that important. Playboy hadn't called any of us, so...
And the reconstruction option that we had is good. They do good. We have wonderful doctors that do good work.
And one of us elected not to have the mastectomy. She had the hysterectomy done with her ovary removal and is still considering mastectomy. You know, ultimately, there's no right or wrong decision. It's just whatever risk you're comfortable with and what works for your life and what's going on with you. The insurance concerns that I had turned out to be a non-issue. Insurance covered it, both the surgery and the reconstruction. I'd like to point out that one of my cousins found out that she had precancerous tissue in her breast and was very thankful that she had done this surgery.
It seemed ironic that it was Loris who had precancerous cells when she had her mastectomy, because she had had to insist, put her foot down and demand to have the genetic test in the first place.
My doctor, too, said she didn't want me to have she didn't recommend the blood test, and she's a very dear friend, and I said, I've had other doctors, and I hope I don't have to get another one again, but I will have the test. And so against her better judgment, I was tested, and then when it was positive, and then especially after my tissue came back, that I was precancerous, and there was no doubt I would have had breast cancer. She said that she had learned from me, and she would treat others differently.
Lessons learned. We learn to be a partner in our own health. It starts with being aware of our health and being proactive and in control rather than reactive. I am thankful that I had this knowledge and this choice. Having the gene to me did not mean a death sentence. I learned that it's important to talk about this. When I was in the hospital, I asked the gynecologist that I was working with what I could do to help others, and he told me to tell my story. And honestly, I was kind of hoping I would be a little farther out than this, but I'm hoping that somebody here today, that this will be helpful for someone here today. I learned that we can be courageous. It's easier to be brave when you know you're being taken care of. I have a real peace about my decision, and I would do it again. If I had the choice, I would do it again. I thank God for putting people in my path every day to encourage me. We have been pleased with the results of the reconstruction. It was great to have everything done right away and to wake up intact. It's really my hope that someday, with technology and research evolving so fast, that other women won't have to make the same choice that we did. What can you do? Listen to your still small voice. If you have a concern or questions, be your own advocate. Ask questions, seek help. 2, do your regular monthly self-breast exams. You know, I'm a nurse. Honestly, I didn't do them every month. I don't know why I didn't. I just didn't. But this is one of the best things you can do. If you know what your breasts feel like normally, if there's a change, you're going to find it, and hopefully you can address the problem before it becomes big. And that's how my mother found her lump too. Be aware of your health history. When you're looking at a family history, usually genetic specialists like to look at 3 generations if that information is available. So if you have a history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer in your family, you might want to look to see who it is and how closely they're related, because that determines how much risk there is to the family and whether it could be a mutation or not. Get your mammograms done. The American Cancer Society and National Cancer Institute recommends that women get mammograms annually from 40 on. However, if you have risk factors or if you have a close relative like a mom or a sister with a disease, then you should get tested sooner, so you need to talk to your physician. I'd like to remind you of the importance of the Bosom Buddy program. By making a donation to this cause, you can help women that can't otherwise afford it, so empower them. And in closing, I know that my family and I are very blessed. My family had its own built-in support group and is here today, including my husband, my dad, 2 of my aunts, and 3 cousins. One of my aunts and my 3 cousins went through the journey with me. All of us went together. I also appreciate the many friends that I see in the audience who were there for us when we had the surgery, and even since then, and here today in support. And I so much appreciate you guys. Thank you for everything you did then and now. And I would like to thank my Aunt Alice for having the courage to get tested and making it happen despite what others said to her or told her. She listened to her still small voice. She then provided information and moral support to all of us. She gave us a real gift that enabled us to make an informed decision and take control of our health. It isn't the end of the world, but in fact a new beginning for us, and I am not worried about what the future holds for me in this area. Lastly, my cousin Laura summed it up when she said, "This gene has always been a part of me, just like my eye color. My knowledge of the genetics doesn't change who I am. The only thing that changes is that now I have a choice in my life." Thank you.
Karen Peterson is BRCA2 positive. So is her Aunt Alice. So are 4 other cousins. They've all reduced their odds of getting breast cancer by 50 to nearly 100% by having major surgeries, hysterectomies, and/or mastectomies. They are informed, strong, and deeply supportive of each other, these girls from the Jane family. As Aunt Alice says,
"Janes are tough."
The main Jane you heard today was Karen Peterson, the keynote speaker at this Pink Tea event. Karen grew up in Genesee. She's a nurse who now works at the hospital where she had been born, Gritman Medical Center, the Pink Tea sponsor. Karen was joined by other tough Janes, her Aunt Alice Jane Spray, and her cousins, Loris Prophet, Amy Peterson, and Connie Ferguson.
This is Yin Radio, and today's program is called Another Boob Show. Breasts are rampant in art. They're everywhere. But when artist Yara Kluver's images of lactating breasts appeared on the brochure for an art show, there was a pushback. And censorship. A prominent community member found the image indecent and wanted it removed from the brochure. The university complied. Breasts banned from art? In this interview with Sandy, Yara Kluver gives perspectives to her education, life, and her work that brought the controversial image into being.
Feminist artist Yara Vieira Kluver was born in Brazil and raised with strong cultural influences from both Brazilian and German backgrounds. She brings an international perspective to her work, as well as an intense examination and celebration of the female experience. Recently, her work is about disrupting the traditional male gaze so prevalent in art, and she challenges the individual to consider the societal impact of turning the tables on traditional perspectives. Her work encourages you to participate actively and wholly in the cultural empowerment of women. Yara Vieira Kluver studied at the Cooper Union School of Art in New York City and received her MFA in photography from Indiana University. And then she studied with the renowned 1970s feminist artist Judy Chicago. After that, she embarked on a visual exploration of the body and its transformation through time and experience. Her focus is primarily on the female body and its cycles, but due to her husband's and her daughter's concurrent long hospitalizations, she's also explored how the materials of the medical world intersect with the materials of the body. Following a well-publicized incident of censorship of one of her controversial pieces, Yara Kluver began to tour institutions of higher learning to highlight some of the current issues surrounding the censorship of feminist art. Yara Fiera Kluver spoke with me during her visit to Moscow, Idaho on November 7, 2006, following a presentation to University of Idaho students. Here's a major portion of our interview, which first aired on Yin Radio on November 9, 2006. Welcome, Yara.
Thank
you. Appreciate you coming and spending some time with me today.
I'm really pleased to be doing this.
Thanks. Let's talk a little bit about your time with Judy Chicago first. It was a kind of transformative time for you, and it wasn't a very long period, though, as I understand it. Tell me a little bit
right.
about that work and how that was influential for you.
Right. Well, first of all, I knew of Judy Chicago before I met her. I actually, my mother had a book of hers about the dinner party and the making of the dinner party that I had seen as a child, and it had an influence, it had an impact on me as a child. And when I said in my talk yesterday that, you know, I've been a feminist since the age of 9, it's because, well, first of all, I was a child during the 70s, and I was exposed to things like that, and I could tell, I could relate to that. Having grown up also in a family, you know, my father is a professor and very involved in the art world, always going to museums. My parents really exposed us to a lot of art. From an early age then, I could just, even though I couldn't verbalize it, when I walked into art institutions, I could tell that there was a disconnect for me. I admired a lot of the stuff. I wanted to be an artist, but there was a disconnect. And when I'd see things like the dinner party, this book my mother had about the dinner party, I could relate. But, you know, I couldn't formulate all of this into theories about anything or what was going on exactly for me. So I knew about Judy Chicago. And I studied with her for just a semester, so, you know, it was from the very end of August until mid-December. But yes, it had an enormous impact, also because of what I was going through at the time. It just sort of came at the right time when I needed to be pushed in the direction she pushed me in terms of really speaking directly and honestly and openly about an experience I'd had.
And this experience you'd had is related to medical issues?
Right, is related to the birth of my daughter. Well, first, my husband's hospitalization just before the birth of my daughter, which, you know, that was all about, was I was pregnant at the time, and we didn't know if he would survive. So, you know, was I going to be a family with my daughter? And then, you know, a month after he comes home from the hospital, she's born, and she's in the hospital for 11 weeks. So it was, you know, about these notions we have of family and our expectations about family and this big, important aspect of, you know, life experience. So, yeah, it was, you know, the work really got into all of the emotional aspects related to being in the hospital.
And you're talking about being pushed by her and by that experience. And how can you describe that? I mean, what was different? Mm-hmm. Because of that experience in your work?
Well, what was different, you know, the first day, or in the first few days that this group of women started meeting, the studio class started meeting with Judy Chicago, we were looking at work that we had done previously. So I was showing this work I'd done as a graduate student, which I was very pleased with. I still like this body of work. And I've always dealt with the body, the female body and the male body in my work, but in a very sort of veiled, more ambiguous, more poetic way. You know, it was about trying to create something beautiful, but in a strange way, not about your typical kind of beauty. But it was just, you know, it when I look at it now, it's what is expected. It was expected of me, you know. Whether or not what I was doing has a particular female aesthetic, I think you could argue for that. It's sort of difficult to there's a fine line, you know. But, you know, I think the important thing is that I was making work that was veiled, and Judy Chicago pointed to that right away. And she's pretty, I don't want to say she's narrow in her focus, but, you know, she has a goal in mind, which is to open women up to possibilities that are not open to them. And so the idea of working big and bold and direct are things that women typically do not do. It's what's expected of men. We see a lot of male art that's very big and bold and out there and takes up a lot of space, and it's not a question, you know. It's not a form in which women work. So I think Judy Chicago recognizes that and as a result really pushes women in that direction. And it's very uncomfortable for a lot of women. As is evidence, there's a documentary film that was made about my experience studying with her, about the group of 11 women that studied with her in 1999. It's called No Compromise, Lessons in Feminist Art with Judy Chicago. And that documentary really, you can really see how a lot of women resist it. It's very difficult to go there, you know.
So you started working more on the edge and pushing yourself, and your art then led you into a controversy. Mm-hmm. And this, I'd like to talk about that a little bit, the DePaul controversy, where at the 2002 faculty art show, your work caused the upper level people right. to kind of have a little problem. There.
Well, you know, it wasn't, interestingly, it wasn't the show itself, it was the image depicted in the brochure, which went out to a wide public. And that's why I talk about context in the talk that I give, that, you know, the brochure simply has a piece that's representative of each artist exhibiting work with no kind of context, except that it's a faculty art show. So the controversy was surrounding the image that showed up in the brochure, not about people who went to see the show.
Understood. And let's describe the image.
Okay. Well, it's called Built to Suck. It's a fairly large image. It's a triptych. And so I took it has three images, my breasts with my daughter's face sandwiched between the two breasts. The breasts are lactating. They're photographs, so it's very realistic. Formerly, I was interested in the three U shapes, how my daughter's face resembled the face or the shape of my breasts. So formerly, there's that. But it's meant as an homage to women and our ability to give birth and how our bodies change as a result and how the breasts take on a certain function. It sort of speaks to all of that. And then there's a second layer of meaning, which is my daughter with her medical complications has a swallow disorder and could not breastfeed. So it's called Built to Suck because she's built for that. Her face is shaped in order to latch onto the breast. I was built to feed, but we couldn't have that relationship and had to relate to machines instead. So there's sort of another layer of meaning, which then relates to the rest of the work that deals with the hospital materials and so on.
So it's interesting that an image that, you know, a breast primarily, I mean, you assume that's probably the controversial part because that's, you know, what we hide in our society, but we don't hide it in art normally. So that became controversial, even as a single image, even out of context. It kind of strikes me as surprising.
Right, right. That's exactly my point, is that, you know, and I'm focusing on art, you know, the art world. The breast is a very common theme. You know, we see it, it's rampant in our art institutions. But, you know, the point I make is that the gaze which is taken, the viewpoint or what's expressed about the breast is the issue. So what we see in our art institutions are breasts that are there as objects of pleasure and desire and male desire. We have, you know, loads and loads of images that that are from the male gaze, which takes a very passive view of the woman. You know, the woman is objectified. So the work that I did, the way that I portrayed the breast, was a way that showed a woman, well, a different function for the breast, and, you know, a woman empowered. I mean, it's a powerful act to give birth, to feed your child, to you know, this life force. So that's the issue. And we're also just not used to seeing images of lactating breasts, you know, they're not common, so.
Now you've referred to the male gaze, and I'm not sure if that is related to a masculine aesthetic. I mean, it sounds to me like it is, mm-hmm. but just to be clear, making sure I'm not missing something that's a phrase in the art world that I've missed.
Sure, yeah, no.
Versus perhaps a female gaze or separatist. And you're asking students, you know, mm-hmm. to consider, is there a female aesthetic? Can you talk a little bit about the male gaze and what we mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
And and then something about, we'll move into, alternative gazes.
Okay, yeah. Well, the two terms that I used in my talk yesterday, the male gaze is one, and the other is the oppositional gaze, which was a term coined by bell hooks, a feminist theorist. Well, let me start out by saying that we don't, until you study something like, feminist theory or art theory regarding the gaze, I don't think you enter art institutions, museums, galleries, whatever, thinking about things in that way. Generally, I think we consider that what we encounter there is a universal experience, that what we see somehow represents everybody, and it's assumed. I think the art institutions, as they're putting their collections together, that's what they're assuming. We're representing this, it has universal appeal. But in fact, the statistics are that, the works by women, only 5% of what you have in your major institutions are works made by women. That means 95% are made by men. The question is, do men have a different approach from women? Well, I would say yes, because of exactly what I've talked about. Typically what you see, and the images that I show in my talk, are the woman as objectified, passive, not involved, except as an object of pleasure, not as energized or as a creator, but as a muse, So the male gaze is that's what it is. It's the gaze that's taken on the female body, and many other aspects as well. But I'm focusing here on the body. So the oppositional gaze then, which comes out of the 70s feminist movement, is is there a different approach to the female body that where you take her out of the passive role, active, energized, creative, and that speaks honestly and openly about the experience of a woman from a female perspective. And you have to really see the, we can talk about it here, but it's very important to see examples of these images as well. And I think by seeing them, you see that difference,
It's been a pleasure to meet you, and I thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Thank you so very much.
You've been listening to an interview with Yara Fiera Kluver, a feminist artist who visited the University of Idaho on November 7th, 2006. On the second trip around town for this boob show, Anna Maria asked men what they think about boobs and breast surgery.
Fascination with boobs.
Boobs? We don't have them, I guess. It's kind of, I don't know. They're fun to look at because they come in all different shapes and sizes. A friend of mine would say that it's a Freudian thing. Maybe we like them so much because we're used to them with our mothers. I'm sure. I don't know. They're a joy to this world. They make life better, I think.
What do you think of breast implants?
I'm for them.
You for them?
Yeah.
Do you like big boobs then?
Well, if they look normal, if they don't look fake,
What about
if they're
feel?
Super, I'd prefer them to be softer than when they have implants inside of them, because they're harder in that sense.
Have you ever felt fake boobs before?
I don't think so.
Certainly have an aunt that just kind of needed them to be smaller. They were unwieldy and uncomfortable, so I could understand that sort of wanting to reduce in order to make something that's more comfortable, easier, more helpful. But I think generally this culture has a lot has this obsession, this idolizing over image, over some small conception of beauty that looks like Barbie and is displayed in Cosmo. So I wouldn't normally support someone just going and getting plastic surgery, let's say increase their breast size, because I think it's not important, and that they, I don't know everything, but I would ask the question if they're maybe trying to get attention, or if they're trying to find their worth in something that isn't going to give them help their self-worth at all. It's just going to get more stares from men, and then he'll get the wrong attention. Yeah, that's my thought. I think they need to ask real good question as to why, and I think that ultimately our meaning is found in Christ instead of trying to obsess over our physical appearance.
Today's Yin Radio program has been another Boop Show, and we'll end it with music by Deidre Flint singing her song, The Boop Fairy.
When I was in my teenage years, I did just what I should. I listened to my mother, and I was kind and sweet and good. And my friends and I did rituals, and I prayed with all my might that this would be the evening that she'd stop along her flight. Well, that was several years ago, and that chick's long overdue. And it's time I came to terms with something plainly clear to you. The Boop Fairy never came for me. No, the Boop Fairy never came for me. Okay, I'm spunky, and I'm cute, and I've got a great personality. The Boop Fairy never came for me. Well, we were the third house on a country drive. I thought maybe she just got lost. So I hung my bra on the mailbox till the neighbors took it off. And all my friends got visits and expanded through the years. And left me wailing to the gods, buying training bras at Sears. Still I harbor hopes she'll come for me, I know she will. I'd get 'em done myself if she'd agree to foot the bill. The Boop Fairy never came for me. No, the Boop Fairy never came for me. Look, I wasn't wanting melons, just a cute curvaceous bee. But the Boop Fairy never came for me. This isn't a song about boobs, not really. The boobs are just a set of metaphors to symbolize everyone's fear of human inadequacy. Hey, we've all felt the pain of being dissed by one fairy or another. So during the next refrain, I want you to join in with me with your own fairy that never paid a call. Maybe it's the height fairy or the butt nymph. Men, maybe it's the pectoral or hair fairy. Or maybe some other fairy you just want to mumble about. Look, nobody's going to ask you to enunciate. And sisters, I don't want you feeling alienated right now because you happen to be full-figured. Just change the line to the Boop Fairy just wouldn't let me be, or the Boop Fairy became obsessed with me. Okay, here comes the refrain. Everybody, join in. The Boop Fairy never came for me. No, the Boop Fairy never came for me. Though the Hip Fairy came two times, and the Thigh Fairy came three. The Boop Fairy never came for me. That Boop Fairy never came for me.
Listen to past shows or podcast this show, or sign up for electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfoundation.org. That is yinradio@v as in voice, p as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and heard on Boise Community Radio at radioboise.org, and on other stations around the country. This show was produced by Anna-Maria Roque and Sandy Billings. Music is by Paula Cole and Deidre Flint. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Sandy Billings is an executive producer. I'm on Mariah Roque. Thank you for joining me today.